And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
The good king had died, and no one could decide who was rightful heir to the throne. It seemed that the land would be torn by war, or saved by a miracle alone. The sword in the
stone. 2018, Hope and Chris finish the last episode of Star Wars The Clone Wars. Luckily, dependable Dave Filoni and crew create Rebels with new characters, new places, and new adventures, thus keeping hope alive for this podcast. Welcome to J-Guys and Jedi.
Hi everyone, welcome to a brand new episode of J-Guys and Jedi, a weekly podcast covering every episode of Star Wars Rebels. In this episode, Sabine begins training with the ancient Darksaber, but in doing so, she must also face her past. There will be a lot of feelings because we're diving into Sabine's history in the most painful way possible. We're talking about Trials of the Darksaber this week. How you doing, Chris?
Doing good. Yeah, I'm just going to sit back in this one. This is a Hope episode top to bottom. Top to bottom. Not that I didn't like this show, this episode. I liked it quite a bit, but boy, it's certainly pushing the hope buttons. All without like Callus and Thrawn or anything like that. None of the bad guy buttons. It's all your good guy buttons this week.
I know. I was surprised by what I scored this episode when I actually went back and thought about it. No spoilers yet. We're not there yet. But I was very surprised when I was like sitting down thinking about it, and I was like, I can't think of anything wrong with this episode. It was very difficult because like I remembered enjoying this episode and I recognized it as one of the best episodes of Rebels and I liked it. But when I went back and really rewatched it, like as we do on the podcast with a fine tooth comb, I was just like, oh, wow, there's so much more. So I was surprised by my score, which we'll have to end here at the end of the episode. So, well, you having a good week, Dave? I haven't spoke to you in like two days.
2 days. So far, so good. It was beautiful and sunny here today.
Here, too. We've gotten something like four or five months worth of rain in like our first 3 months. Like we're like 14 inches above average. So we've had like four straight days of sun and we haven't had four straight days of sunlight since Christmas. So it was so beautiful today.
Yep.
I spent like a good like 15 minutes crying today because I finally sat down and watched the last three episodes, like the final three episodes of My Little Pony. And they were so emotional. Like, some of them have kids. Two of them might be queer together. Some of them might be dating. Twilight's a queen, and there's all these feelings. And I was just like, friendship is magic. Because, like, I was watching this show when I worked at Hot Topic. And I worked at Hot Topic over 6 years ago, at least. It's been 5 or 6 years since I worked at Hot Topic, because I remember debating with my manager / longtime friend Bill. We were debating My Little Pony because he was watching the show too, and I remember having those debates while at work. So like I've been watching this show for half a decade. So I just to finally like see it finish, I was just like, friendship is magic, and they're all grown up, and some of them have kids, and Pinkie Pie is married to Weird Al Yankovic, and I'm so happy for everybody. Spoilers for the My Little Pony finale.
There you go. Yeah, geez.
Pinkie Pie and Cheese Sandwich get married and they have a son, and Cheese Sandwich is a character voiced by Weird Al Yankovic, so they get married and have a son. Name Little Cheese. So cute. Pinkie Pie's a mommy, and Rainbow Dash and Applejack look like they're a couple. It's not 100% confirmed, but they were getting at each other about, like, who does what chores at their house. And I was just like, oh, they're gay. It was wonderful. I enjoy it so much. And so that was my day. I pretty much just worked for my stepmom and finally sat down and wrapped up My Little Pony. And I did more work on my website. So Geeky Girl Experience is coming right along. I got all of my Resistance reviews up. So those are all up, and now I'm working on my Mandalorian reviews. And I think I was saying this last week that it's really funny, like, going back to, like, the earlier reviews and, like, seeing how I was speculating while knowing what I know now. And it was so tempting to change things. And I didn't. I preserved them. Except for one. I did alter one review, which was my review for The Gunslinger, the episode with Ming-Na Wen's character. And I love Filoni to, like, the world and back. But there has to be a bigger conversation about how he has a track record of fridging women. Like, he absolutely fridges female characters for the sake of male characters. And I listed, like, 7 examples just from Clone Wars, not counting his other shows. So that was the only thing I really changed so far while updating. And I took all the Jeffs out, because I used to jokingly call the Mando Jeff, but I was like, let me make this more professional. So I actually changed. I took out all the Jeffs too, calling him Jeff. But yeah, Geeky Girl Experience is coming right along.
Excellent.
I had a busy day. Now I think about it, I've been very productive today. Well, strapping, guys. We already know that this is going to be a long episode because I have a bajillion pages of notes. So you want ready to get into this?
I'm ready to get going.
All right. Here we go. Trials of the Darksaber is the 52nd episode of Star Wars Rebels, and it was released on January 21st, 2017. It was written by Dave Filoni and directed by Stuart Lee. Some extra information for you. The working title of this episode was The Blade Trials. Very glad they changed it, because that sounds dumb. Early scripts had Kanan reaching out to Bindu on how to best train Sabine, but this was later changed to him confiding in Hera to keep the family element strong. Sorry, I inhaled some spit. You can leave that in there. The artwork in Sabine's room has been updated since season 1. She now has paintings of the space family together, Lando, Ketsu, Lothcats, Purgles, Puffer Pigs, and a picture of Callus and Zeb with arms around each other that says under it, best friends. Wink, wink. This episode has a rare example of 2D animation being used with a 3D animated show. During the opening scene about the history of Tara Vizsla and the Darksaber, I now see that I misspelled Tara Vizsla. Anyway, the Rebels recon for this episode talked about the development of the Darksaber in Clone Wars. Originally, Pre Vizsla was going to have a vibroblade, but George Lucas said it wouldn't hold up against a lightsaber in a fight. So George Lucas decided to create the Darksaber for the series. As they developed Rebels and brought Maul back into the show, they realized that Maul was the last person to have the Darksaber and that it could fall into Sabine's hands. So they used this opportunity to widen the mythology of the Darksaber, its relationship to the Jedi, and how it fits into Mandalorian culture, to later go on to the show The Mandalorian. They also talk about this episode is so unique because it's not plot-focused, but all character-driven. They don't have some big rebellion mission or anything. Focusing on training allows for both Kanan to accept his space daughter is growing up and he has to let her go. It also allows for Sabine to have a character breakthrough to relearn how to embrace her Mandalorian past. This is also a rare episode where Dave Filoni prepped the voice actor beforehand. Normally, he tells them just enough of what they need to know for the time that they are recording a single episode. But for this episode, he told Sabine's voice actor, Tia Sakaar, about the plot in Sabine's past to prepare her for this performance. He wanted her to be as emotional and raw as she could while recording. He also said that this is a rare episode where they recorded voices first and then shot the episode. Normally, it's the other way around. But he wanted to build the episode off of Tia Sakaar's performance. You know who also builds off performances.
Performance, yes.
How you doing this week, Yoda?
Yoda is a high-performance machine. Vroom, vroom.
Getting those, rev that up. It's not funny when I do it, huh?
No.
Just a dead no. Oh, come on, Yoda.
Not funny.
Okay, I'm sorry. Are you having a good week, Yoda?
Yeah, not bad.
It's starting to get warm here. Is it starting to get warm on Dagobah?
Always warm on Dagobah.
That's true. You guys don't really have a winter, do you?
Well,
I got a question for you this week. You ready?
Yoda has swamp butt. Mm.
Swamp butt? Mm. Mm. Do you need, like, an ointment for that?
Mm. Yoda needs manpon. Mm.
Anyway, I have a question for you, Yoda.
Yes, a question for Yoda.
Yeah. So I got to thinking this episode, do you and Bindu ever hang out or talk on the space phone or something?
Bindu, good friend of Yoda's. Yes, Yoda's wingman. Yes. Go out on the town with the Bindu. Yes.
Do you guys do a Rey and Kylo force connection to talk to each other when you're not near each other?
Maybe. Maybe Bindu knows future, so Yoda knows who to talk to.
I just imagine you guys sitting in a little hut on Ahch-To, just reaching out hands towards each other slowly. Mm-hmm. But Bindu is the hut because he's so big.
Bindu does not sit in little huts, no.
Mm. He is the hut. Bindu the hut.
Oh.
But with one T. So what's a normal night for you and Bindu?
Mmm. Dressed up? Mmm. Out on the town? Yes. Drinky. Mmm.
Ooh, dapper.
Mmm. Talk to ladies? Yes.
You guys head over to Canto Bight?
Yeah. Yoda's not allowed in Canto Bright anymore.
What are you doing in
Canto Bright? Yeah. Maybe went to the stables. I don't know. Yoda was drinky.
Did you release all the horse thingies?
I don't know. Yoda may have visited horses. Yes. Maybe. Nice horses.
Did you and Bindu ride on some horses, even though the image of Bindu?
Bindu rode too many horses.
He squished too many horses, you mean?
I had to leave Canto Bright.
Oh, R.I.P. horses. All right, Yoda. Well, you'll go off and go call your buddy Bindu and go hang out some more, okay?
Yeah, they're probably gossiping about us right now.
Those poor horses. The image of Bindu trying to ride one is just horrible.
No good. The Bindu hanging out with Yoda is not a good sign.
Oh man, him and Bindu'd.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Bindu is one thing, but Bindu'd. Yeah, they have a good time. All right, well, you ready to get into this?
I'm ready. Are you ready?
No, I am. Sorry, I had to double tap that burp. All right, Act One.
Act One.
We open on the rebel base with Finn rawr, going onto the ghost. Sabine sees him and is like, I think there's some bullshit afoot. Rao meets with Kanan in his room on the ghost, and Kanan's like, dude, check this out. And Kanan lights up the darksaber, and Rao is like, there's no way! And Kanan's like, yes way, we stole it from Darth Maul! And Rao then gives a history lesson. The Darksaber once belonged to a dude named Tar Vizsla, this time I spelled it correctly, who was a rare Mando Jedi. After he died, the Jedi did what they do best, conceal, don't feel. So they concealed the Darksaber away without the feels of the Mando. Well, the Mandos weren't too happy about that, so they came and stole it back. it became a status symbol on Mandalore of whoever wielded it, held the power to rule. And Rao ends the story saying, "Gee whiz, Sabine is part of House Vizsla. I bet she's super excited to find this." And Kanan's like, "Yeah, not so much. No. She gave it to me and then has been hiding in her room listening to loud music. You know, as teenagers do." And Rao is like, "You're way too soft on her. If she wields this thing, she could rule Mandalore, or at least unite it against the Empire." And Kanan's like, "Excuse you. My daughter still has a curfew. Let's slow down a moment." And then the title card pops up, which is the end of the scene. Chopper fetches Sabine out of her room, and she goes into the common room where everyone in the Space family and Rao are waiting for her. She flat out says that she refuses to use the Darksaber. She points out that Maul ruled Mandalore and fucked over her house. Friendly reminder that Sabine's mom served with Darth Death Watch under Maul back during the Clone Wars, so Sabine's family knows firsthand what the Darksaber can do to her planet. Rao wants her to use it to unite the planet, and Sabine is like, "Well, my space dad would never approve of this, right, Dad?" And Kanan's like, "Maybe you should hear him out," which catches everyone off guard. And Ezra pulls the, "She can't fight like a Jedi." And Sabine says that she knows all sorts of fighting, but wants nothing to do with a lightsaber. Rao continues to push about how symbolic the blade is. Sabine flat out says that her family is kind of messed up, but she doesn't say why her family is messed up. She also states that the space family on the Ghost is her family now. But it's Hera that pulls out the rebellion card. Hera says that an army of Mandos would be so good for the rebels. I can't talk tonight, Chris. I can't talk. Hera says, "I know firsthand that families can..." Go back and say that one again. Hera says, "I know firsthand that families can suck. My dad is a crazy rebel guy too, and we're just now patching things up. But I have to ask you to do this for the greater good." And Kanan doubles down, but he also points out that it's still Sabine's choice. They can ask Sabine, but it has to be Sabine who makes the choice. Sabine reluctantly agrees, but Kanan doesn't hand over the blade. He points out that she will be challenged, and she has to be ready for that. She says okay. Kanan gives her the saber, and it's time for the training to begin. What'd you think of Ekwan? Other than my lack of reading skills.
It was pretty good. Don't have a lot of notes. I'm doing all the surface stuff, and I'll let you do all the human emotion, which is most of this episode. So I have very, very few notes, because I knew what was coming on this episode. Those Bendu formations that are all over the place. You ever notice that? There's all these things that look like Bendu. I wonder if they look like Bendu, if Bendu looks like rock formations, or if those are plants or whatever. But
wouldn't it be kind of cool if it's sort of like Bendu, all Bendu, and it's just kind of his way to spy on them?
It could be, and he just like pops out when he has to. It could very well be.
Like Whack-A-Mole, but with Bendu.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, I'm here, yeah.
There's just a funny scene in here where Chopper purrs.
I saw that. It actually says in the subtitles, purring.
Yeah, he purrs like a cat when he gets pet. And basically my only other note is from here on out, like Rebels pretty much goes with the rite of passage theme for everybody. Not that it hasn't been happening all the way through, but this is where it really starts like happening for everybody.
What do you mean by rite of passage?
I think
I know what you mean.
Well, all the characters are young in this, and they're all in a weird place, and they're all going places, but they aren't in their places yet. They're in their place where they are now, but they're all going somewhere, you know, by the end of season four, and they're all like on their way to their eventual journeys to what ends up.
I kind of half agree, half disagree with that, because it is true they've all been already they are all going places, but the way I half disagree with that is I think everybody has already been on that path except for Sabine. Like, this is
that's what I'm saying. Now they're all on the path. Now everybody's got somewhere they're going now.
Gotcha. I thought you meant like they're all starting from here, and I'm like, I'm pretty sure the rest of them's already on their way.
No, it's been going on since the beginning of the show, but I mean, like, from here on out, it becomes like almost like the main play. Everybody's having it, so it's, you know, from the bad guys to the good guys. So.
Okay. I misunderstood. I thought you meant like they were all starting now, and I'm like, I think Zeb's already on that journey.
Zeb's everybody's on the way except for basically Sabine.
Yeah, and this is her start. Okay, I see what you're saying.
And that's all I got.
I'm surprised you didn't have anything about the 2D animation scene.
It was neat. It reminded me of the ending, the last few episodes of, or maybe it was even the last episode of the Tartakovsky one, where they visited those natives, those sort of bear creatures that were getting that were getting mutated.
And remember that
Anakin was like their savior, and they they told the story by the fire, and the shadows on the wall told the whole story in a. But that whole show is 2D animated, but it was the same sort of idea, you know?
I'm trying to... It reminded me... I'm sorry, I meant to look this up sooner.
Disney does stuff. It's very Disney.
Yeah, it reminds me of, like, old Shadow plays, but I'm trying to remember the person who actually invented it.
Shadow plays have been around since like the old times. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a woman in particular who like made it mainstream. But I don't remember her name. But yeah, that's what it reminded me of, was like those old kind of shadow plays where they have like puppets, but like they tell the story through shadows and they just kinda like
move
it around. That's what it reminded me of. I love that scene. We'll start there, because that's my first note, is about the 2D animation scene of the Darksaber. I actually have two notes for this. So the first one is, I love that moment and the fact that Finn Rao and Kanan are having that conversation, because the Darksaber is significant to both of them, but for completely different things. Because the Darksaber has significance to Kanan as a Jedi, because it's part of Jedi history. But it also has meaning to Finn Rao as a Mandalorian, because it's a big piece of Mandalorian history. So I'd like that they are both coming at it from... they both have a mutual respect for it, but it's...
I think that's why Finn Rao isn't angry that Kanan is actually wielding the Darksaber when he's talking to him.
Yeah.
I thought of that. I'm like, he should be like, that's not yours to handle. But then I was like, thinks a Jedi's okay, but then I forgot it's a Jedi relic too, actually.
Yeah, and so I like that they both have the same kind of respect for it, but for completely different reasons, and it's nice seeing them both respecting this object, which then in turn makes them respect each other more. So that's a really well played out scene. And then my other note about that scene is, I love the wording that Finn Rao uses when he talks about how House Vizsla got back the Darksaber from the Jedi. He specifically says that they liberated the Darksaber, which was a very strong word. Liberating is a very, very strong word to use, especially
for the Mandalorians are pretty strong people, you know? they're not mealy-mouthed.
Oh, yeah, but, like, there's a plethora of words that he could have used, but the word liberate invoked almost this, like, idea of colonization in the dialogue. And we, like, when we talk about colonization in Star Wars, it's usually used to describe the Empire. And on some occasions, I've seen people use it to talk about the Republic, because the Republic was trying to make everybody, like, conform to, like, the Republic standards, and, like, some people didn't do that, and they got colonized. So it was very interesting to see this, like, very, like, colonialized word, liberated, being used for the Jedi, but it also kind of makes sense as well, because look what the Jedi do. They take babies away from their culture and raise them to their standards, so they're not part of their culture anymore.
Every Sith was liberated from the Jedi.
Yeah, I mean, so, like, in a way that the Jedi were, in a way, colonizers in like their own kind of way. So I really loved that specific word choice that he used was being liberated.
It's funny because I took it a totally different way because in the circles I run in.
How did you take it?
In the circles I run in, the word, I agree with your point, actually, but like I just took it a different way. I always took liberated. Liberated to means, yeah, I stole it, but it was mine to begin. It wasn't supposed to be with you. It was supposed to be with me. That's what I've known many people who've liberated things. You know what I mean?
Which would make sense to him as a Mandalorian because he would see that as, because that's part of his past. So it does make sense in that context as well.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, they to them, they would not feel that they stole it, but that's the physical act that they did. So being Mandalorian, you don't mince words that much. Liberated sort of says it all. But like it works, and that's the great thing about language. It works with your interpretation of it too, completely.
That was such a really like chef's kiss worth of like a great word choice. I loved it. So my next word note is a little bit of speculation for Mandalorian season 2. Rao mentioned that family is important to all Mandalorians, and it got me thinking about season 2 of The Mandalorian, and if we're going to see kind of like those found family Rebels vibes when we go back to Din Djarin and Baby Yoda, because like they're both foundlings now, and so of course they don't have like a house to like House Vizsla that they're associated with. Actually, Death Watch saved Din Djarin, so he might actually associate with House Vizsla for all we know, but it hasn't been confirmed yet. But
no, when Baby Yoda became made a foundling, it's like official now. Like he was feeling like he knew he was supposed to take care of Baby Yoda and he liked Baby Yoda, but he was feeling funny about it, you know, because he was a little conflicted. But now that they're both foundlings, he's, you know, there's, I don't know like exactly what the rules are, but you know there's a lot of rules connected to probably having no harm fall upon the foundling, and he'll have the force of the Mandalorians, you know, whatever's left of the Mandalorians behind it, too. So,
and they did say that he is now, like, as Baby Yoda's father.
Yeah, yeah, he is his caretaker. He's, like, officially in the Mandalorian, you know, framework. He is Baby Yoda's father. So yeah, I imagine Mandalorians protect their kids. Well, we've seen how Mandalorians protect their kids when it's unofficial. Now it's official. So
yeah. So it may, like, because something that Dave Filoni does so well is the found family aspect of Rebels. I'm wondering if we're going to see a lot of those same kind of Rebel beats coming into season 2 of The Mandalorian, which I'm all for.
Yes, we will. Especially, that is what Baby Yoda is for. Baby Yoda is to make that aspect of the show palatable to the people who are gonna want it to be just an action show forever. You know, it can't be an action show forever. It's got to develop some story and have some different things if it goes on. Yeah, not that like the stories that it's based on didn't go on for like 40 years and stuff like that. But it did. But the characters came into that and stuff like that, and they're gonna have to have wider themes. And bottom line, it's Disney.
And so, and Baby Yoda is also there to make a shit ton of money.
yeah. And I mean, I'm not sure. Now everybody's saying Disney made Baby Yoda make a ton of money. If they did, and I don't know how they would fumble this, but they kind of fumbled it, because if you were going to make Baby Yoda, if you made Baby Yoda with the plan for it to sell a million toys, have those toys ready. You know what I mean?
They did that to hide it, though, because I every time, like, I always think of whenever a new Marvel movie is coming out, they always prep the toys beforehand, but there's always toys that leak online. And it would have absolutely have spoiled the surprise. And I forgot, I think it was a article I was reading on The Hollywood Reporter, But it was talking about the decision that Jon Favreau made to not to hide Baby Yoda. And, like, he had to convince them. Like, he's like, I know it's going to take a hit in the toys. I know that your guys aren't going to be prepared for it. And they actually said that, like, some of the, like, the Disney executives said, like, they knew Baby Yoda would be popular. They did not realize how popular he was going to be. So they, like, once, they were still in prepared, production, but they were also completely blindsided about how wildly popular he was. Like,
I'll just put it this way. Once you're in production, you have to build Baby Yoda. They had to build toy Baby Yodas, right?
Yeah.
They had to build them for the movie. And there had to be people in that movie who knew that there was a Baby Yoda, like a lot of people, and a lot of people who build models and mock-ups and stuff like that. Can't tell me that they couldn't have a, while you're at it, you know, come up with a few ideas for the toys just instead.
I'm sure had ideas, but they couldn't release those to, say, like Hasbro or something like that, because it's usually like people within Hasbro's that are the people who put out spoilers for movies through toys.
But I mean, when it came to the point of where, I mean, at some point you got to make toys. When the Baby Yoda was out of the bag, and toys, they should have gone to Hasbro with 40 different designs.
I'm sure they did.
On the plate. They did eventually, but boy, oh boy, they had a lot of time where the Etsy people were making up the slack on that. So
yeah, I forget where I read this, but I was reading that, like, I don't think it was Hasbro. I think it's who does have the Star Wars license right now? Whoever has the Star Wars license, I don't think it's Hasbro. But like there was like an insider saying that some of like their executives were pissed because they were not ready for Christmas, and they were mad because they lost that money.
That's what happened with that. That goes. It's kind of reminiscent. It kind of brings people back to the original Star Wars when they were like, oh my, you know, George Lucas definitely knew there were going to be toys, but they were unprepared for the demand for the toys, and they were selling people cards with a promise of toys in the future and stuff. Yeah.
To learn more about that, go on Netflix and watch The Toys That Made Us. They document that very well.
Yep.
Also, the Lego episode did a good job documenting that with Star Wars as well, because they were talking about how, like, during the prequel era, they kept missing the mark on the Legos for Star Wars, and they just kept missing that mark, and so that was a really good episode too. My next note is, I love that Hera and Kanan give Sabine the choice of what to do. Because they flat out say, like, this is our work argument. This is how this is important to the rebellion. But then they let their parent side come out, and their parent side comes out, and they're like, here's what we need you to do. But as your space parents, we are going to let you, space daughter, have the choice in this matter, and you can walk away.
Clear which one they'd rather have her take, for sure. That I mean, definitely, like, it was nice of them to offer her an out, but they, like, I think they get, you know, they did it very, very deftly, where they pretty much told her, this is what you should do. You can back out of it. There might have been a little parental guilt in there attached to it. You know, you can pull out of it, and that's totally fine. Totally fine. But I think that, I mean, I think they gave her a push that she needed, you know. That's what this whole show is, this episode is about, is her getting the push that she needs, because she doesn't want to deal with her family. And everything, all the stuff that she'd have to do this, is attached to her family, and she's just like, no, I don't want to deal with that. So they have to just sort of like push her through this, you know. She wants to be pushed through it too, as you see, you know. She's getting, you know, the what she needs to go. It's a rite of passage thing, you know. I mean, it starts out with her looking at her very, very, like, childlike drawings, you know, happy childlike drawings, and going like, yeah, all that, you know, that little happy picture there is going to look a lot different to me if I go into this. Then, you know, I'm going into battle basically in all ways.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And then my last note is, I love the twist on the Yoda line that Ezra says, because it's a riff on the line, do or do not, there is no try. But Ezra changes it to, don't try, just learn. And I like that, because way, way, way back in season one, Kanan had pulled up the whole, like, do or do not, there is no try. And Ezra was like, well, what the fuck does that mean? And Kanan's like, I don't know.
Yoda just a Jedi says. Thing. It's like at McDonald's when they tell you if you got time to lean, you got time to clean.
Yeah. But I like it here because it expands on that line and it actually is the lesson of what Yoda was trying to teach Luke. But it's set in a different way to show also Ezra's growth that he's learned from season one.
I mean, fundamentally, they're similar statements, but don't try, just do, and don't try, just learn are two different things. But yeah. When Luke was getting don't try, just do, he was further along in Jedi training, you know. Also,
he'd been Jedi training for like a year, was he?
I also think at this point, Ezra and Kanan are being a little bit Jedi condescending with her about the training because she's not a force wielder. So they're like, okay, we're gonna go give you some of the amateur tricks and stuff so far. But like, don't try, just learn is a little more baby steps than don't try, just do, you know?
Yeah.
So
I do have a note about that in Act 2. Or maybe, no, it's Act 2. But yeah, I do like that change though, because I think like that is what the message that Yoda was trying to put onto Luke in his own Yoda way. But I like how it's phrased here by Ezra, because it shows that Ezra has actually learned that lesson. And mm-hmm. I like that. Mm-hmm. So, but that's all I had for this act. Did you have anything else?
No, I'm ready for Act 2.
All right.
Get into the real meat of this story.
I know. All right, Act 2?
Act 2.
Ezra, Kanan, and Sabine drive out into the wilderness to practice. I still can't read. They set up a mini camp, and Sabine, I almost called her Sadine. Sabine is anxious to get started. Kanan gives her a training saber, which he's not thrilled about, but he needs to see her technique and where she's at. And Ezra's all like, ooh, she's about to get her ass handed to her by Space Dad. Which is exactly what happens. Space Dad does not hold back and just kicks his daughter's ass. He gives training over to Ezra so his Padawan can walk Sabine through the lightsaber forms. A couple days pass, and Hera calls in to check on the progress. The moment Kanan mentions that they're using training sabers, Hera is like, excuse me? At no point did Ezra ever fight with a stick. Are you going easy because she doesn't have the Force? And Kanan says that the Force is in all living things, even Sabine. But Sabine is so conflicted that she's not open to it. So Hera says that she will send out more supplies and wishes them luck. As Sabine and Ezra are sparring, Rao shows up with all their supplies and he adds his opinion to the training. Sabine gets frustrated and loses to Ezra. Kanan calls for a break and makes Ezra work putting up all the shit, which Ezra's not happy about. Rao brings Sabine a gift as a way to apologize for pretty much shoving her head first into the situation. He gives her Mandalorian BAM braces with weapons specifically used to fight Jedi. And it's Mando Christmas, and Rao Santa tells her to take out Ezra. She starts fighting Ezra and easily takes him down with her new Mando gear. But this pisses off Kanan, asking if it's all a game to her. She throws a light whip out and tangles Kanan, but Kanan cuts through it with his lightsaber and takes her down, stating that there was a reason that the Jedi won the war against Mandalore. This upsets Sabine, who calls Kanan a lousy teacher. She throws down her training stick and runs off. Ezra follows her to comfort her, saying that Kanan is tough, but he means well. Sabine says it's not the fighting, which she can do, she's a fighter. She doesn't want the responsibility that comes with the Darksaber. She finally says that her family considers her a traitor, and that they will never accept her back. Ezra flat out pulls the dead parents card, goes all Batman, and says, "At least you have parents to go home to." And he walks off, and Sabine kicks a rock and storms off again. And the rock is actually Ben Dude, who is like, "Oh, man, stop kicking me. So much drama." Kanan calls into his space wife to give her an update. Hera flat out states that Kanan is purposely holding Sabine back and needs to let her commit to this by actually training her with the Darksaber. Hera points out that Sabine's family hurt her more than any lightsaber could hurt her, because Hera went through that with her own father. Hera says to give Sabine the Darksaber, let her own it, and points out that this isn't about Kanan anymore. It's about Sabine. What'd you think of Act 2? Wow, this is, I just kept scrolling and I was like, I have a shit ton of notes.
Yeah, this is like the bulk of your notes is on part 2. Mm-hmm. But the funny thing is, you were like, oh, I got a lot of, and you got a lot of notes for part 3 too. But like, as far as telling the story goes, like, there's not as like much like that you have to write for the story for it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it about evens out. Anyway, I don't think I've ever, he might have been more pissed, but I've never heard Freddie Prinze Jr. like voice act so pissed as in this episode.
I know, it's so good.
But I think we've also only seen a little bit of his the dribs and drabs of his training with Ezra, and it hasn't been the same as this training. So I think we're seeing more of what training is like. We're seeing more of the basic elements of training rather than like just walking in on Ezra and Kanan in a, you know, intermediate or more advanced class or something like that. So we're seeing the basic training, like in the army, you know, where they come in and they break you down before they build you back up, you know.
I have a similar note, and it kind of disagrees with you.
Well, he goes from, well, the funny thing, the thing that cracked me up is he goes from mad to sad, like in the course of like 20 seconds. Like he's regretting his anger with Sabine, like really quickly. And my only other note is Bendu, although I'm going to add to it because when you were talking about, they were going to have Kanan talking to Bendu about how to train Sabine. I think it was a good decision not to, but I like that they left Bendu in it, and I think that was the perfect just little pinch of Bendu into the story. You know, he doesn't even say anything, he just was like,
oh man,
he might not even have been paying attention to any of it, you know, or he might have been, you know, it's hard to say.
He looked right at Sabine.
Well, yeah, because she just kicked him. No. But he might have been just like, oh, what? Oh, okay, whatever. But it was a perfect just that little intrusion of Bendu into it is perfect for it. But that's all I got.
You know, I'm going to start with my Bendu note. But first, I'm going to talk about Convarese. Because in one of the scenes where Sabine and Ezra are training, a Convor flies down and there's a group of Convarees watching over Sabine's training, and we know that these
totally
are Ahsoka's
missed
birds.
That.
Oh yeah, I noticed them right away, and like we know that those are Ahsoka's birds. Like those birds are very much tied into Ahsoka's journey and Ahsoka's stories, and they always show up during important moments of the series. We always see a Convor when something important is happening. And to tie that also into with Bendu, I moved my Bendu note up with my Convor note because I had them separated. I think it's also an interesting moment that Bendu shows up even as a cameo, because like the Convaree, it shows that this is a very important moment in the show. It's an important moment in the Force, and it's also an important moment in the timeline of what's happening. And so even though like the Convors don't do anything but observe, and even though Bendu doesn't say anything, just their presence there show that there is a Force element that is keeping an eye on this.
Yep.
And observing this, and it shows that the force is tuned into this moment.
And he's a deeper element of the Force, you know. Yeah, he is sort of the personification of the Force in these stories.
Yeah, and the Converse are there as observers. And it just has this feeling of the actual Force is watching this, waiting to see how it plays out. Which I just love their symbolism of just, like, they don't really do anything, but it just adds that importance to the episode.
Well, it's like it's her little expression of emotion, and it's also conflicted emotion, which is probably more Bendu's area, because he's in there with the positive and the negative and everything in between. So,
And look at it just like in the timeline aspect, because what happens after that, after this? Sabine takes the Darksaber back to Mandalore. It eventually goes into Bo-Katan's hands, and somehow it ends up in Moff Gideon's hands to go into the Mandalorian timeline. So this is a crossroads for the actual Darksaber as well, depending on what Sabine does and what Sabine chooses. And, like, imagine if she had, like, decided not to take it or gave it up. Where would it have gone? It would have completely altered the rest of the Mandalore plot from here to Mandalorian. It's also just kind of like a crossroads for that as well. So, like, it's like everything is watching this one moment, waiting to see how it plays out.
I agree.
I'm just going to go straight through, because I wrote my notes as they came up chronologically through this act. So some of my notes just kind of develop as the act develop. Starting off, as soon as they start training from the get-go and Sabine fights Kanan with the sticks, I like that Kanan is not going easy on Sabine, and he's tough right from the get-go, but I like that because he knows and respects her enough, knowing that Sabine can take that, and he's not trying to sugarcoat anything because he respects his space daughter in this element.
Yeah, well, and he's also has to change the nature of the relationship, you know? Yeah. Now he's becoming a teacher. And I imagine that kind of being a little tough on him is sort of the way you would start out, you know, training, you know, to set the tone right from the beginning. But yeah, he's definitely trying to give her the full treatment.
I also wonder if he's being extra hard on her as a parent trying to force her to quit, because I go into more of this a little bit later on in my notes, but this is a big Kanan episode too. He's having to learn to let Sabine go as a parent. And he has essentially been her dad. And I'm wondering if he's purposely, for his own feelings of not wanting to let her go, trying to kind of scare her away from this in a way to hold on to her. Does that make sense?
And maybe, but I think at this point, she's kind of committed to it. So I think he's more trying to just impress the fact upon her that, like, this ain't a game of ping pong.
Yeah.
You know, now that you have that thing in your hand, people are going to come to kill you and take it out of your hand. So
yeah,
let's not play around, you know?
I think it could be a little bit of both, because this is definitely a Kanan episode too, which I'll get into more in a minute.
As far as protecting each other from danger, though, the thing is, they sort of met through danger. Danger is their life now. So he knows no matter where Sabine's going, she's going to be fighting, and, you know, unless something radically changes and they all of a sudden win the war, you know, they're not going to be like just sort of. She's not going to be sitting around in an art gallery, you know, displaying her art anytime soon. So, I'm sure he'd rather have her fighting from the ghost, but, like, they are also a rebel team, and, you know, the tactical advantage of Gaten and the Mandalorians is kind of huge, so.
Yeah.
He's working from all different angles and conflictions.
Everything is so complex in this episode, and I love it. Yep, this is a me episode.
Oh, it is.
Oh. Okay. My next note has a little bit of reading. Let me read it first, and then we can discuss it, because I make a couple points in it. I really have to applaud the writing, that they stay away from the trope that Sabine can't fight with a lightsaber because she's a girl. And they frame it in a way that Sabine is having difficulty because she doesn't have the Force like Ezra. This show, like, and a lot of animation has been shifting away from the whole, like, you can't fight because you're a girl narrative. And a lot of shows before this would have framed it that way. And the thing that kept coming to my brain was the first run of DuckTales from the 90s, like the 80s and 90s. Because a constant in the early run of DuckTales was Webby was constantly sidelined because she was a girl. And there's a lot of times in that where Huey, Dewey, and Louie are like, you can't come with us, Webby, because you're a girl and you're going to just not do anything. And she was like, okay, guys. But it shows like just a development in animation in general and writing in animation in this time period, because this was, what, 2-3 years ago? And we've seen how animation has developed since then. And to go back to my DuckTales example, in the new current run of DuckTales, Webby is perfectly capable. She's a fighter. In some ways, she's far more skilled than Huey, Dewey, and Louie, and they also learn from her. So I feel like if Rebels was taking place in an earlier time, say like the 90s, there would have been a narrative of Sabine can't fight because she's a girl, but they were very smart to frame it in this way of they're worried about her wielding a lightsaber because she doesn't have the Force, which is a very nice, smart way to frame this, because at no point Sabine being a girl ever is brought up.
It's hard to say. Well, if in the 90s, yes, okay. Well, it depends. If George Lucas was doing it, though, George Lucas was always like, kind of like, I mean, that's that. I think Clone Wars was his first chance to really be like, I want to really like
write a new kind of girl. And Clone Wars
have stronger female characters, and I think he sort of styled it off the way Disney would do it. But it's what's funny about what you were saying about DuckTales, I'll just add to it, and that sort of that trope of that time. But DuckTales is also sort of spawned from the classic Disney comic books, you know, with Scrooge McDuck and stuff like that, which would also have, you know, the girls would get sidelined. But Disney would always do this thing where, okay, they'd sideline the girls and it's like, oh, the girls can't fight, but they would find some sort of girly thing that the girls would do.
Yeah.
That would help out and or save the day or whatever. And it'd be like, see, the girls can save the day, but they did it by knitting sweaters into a giant web or something stupid
or,
like that.
Or giving,
you know,
the monster a tea party, like something.
Right.
That's very
right.
Cruel.
Exactly. Exactly. And that was always like, I always found that like kind of even more like condescending. It wasn't just condescending. It was also like people have their, you know, everybody has their places, too. And if you work your place well, then everything will work out. But, you know, girls, you don't want to pick up a gun. What you want to do is make sure the guys are fed or, you know, or make up some food with sleeping potion and feed it to the monster or something like that. And I like that we've sort of dispensed with that these days. It's sort that stuff is pretty much done.
And that's something that I really love. It was a particular thing in boy shows, like shows that were considered boy shows. Like girl shows during that time had a lot more like leeway to where it was like, but even then it was like girl power. We fight with our like secret lipstick laser beams. You know, it was still very much that thing.
And they would also sort of like make it better, try to like, quote unquote, make it better by doing the whole other trope of like, well, the guys are kind of stupid. The girls are the ones with the common sense, and they will bail out the guys who are, like, you know, dumb. you know, there's no other way to put it, you know. The guys are always fighting and goofing off and stuff, and the girls have the common sense. And that would even out the, like, the other stuff in the story, but, yeah.
That's actually like one of the reasons why I am just a huge fan of the current of the new run of DuckTales with David Tennant being Scrooge McDuck, like that run, because Webby's an actual character. She's not like the girl version of the three boys. Actually, everybody's an actual character.
Everybody's just a duck. So
yeah, like everyone's an actual character. Like Huey, Dewey, and Louie are three very distinctly different characters. And which is so refreshing that they each have their own personality. Like, Huey is the oldest brother, and he is the protector. Dewey has middle child syndrome and Louis being the youngest is the slacker. They each have like three very different personalities, but so does Webby. Like Webby is her own person. She has a fucking grappling hook and she learned Kung Fu from Mrs. Beakley, who's a retired government agent. And so like Webby is like her own person now, and they each have their own histories with their own personality. Kind of in the same note, I wish I could remember the exact phrase of it, but I might have this in a Hope of All Trades episode, or it might be in our J Guys and Jedi feed. I think it's in our J Guys and Jedi feed, and I could be wrong, but long time ago, I was on a panel at 221 BCon with my friend Heather Holloway, and we were talking about women in sci-fi. And the reason it's in our J Guys and Jedi feed because we talked about Star Wars. And my friend Heather, and I don't remember all the exact details of it, but she was explaining pretty much for this exact reason why He-Man was a more like woman like feminist show than She-Ra was. Because all the women in He-Man did their own things and like had their own like ideas and adventures. But in She-Ra, and I'm talking old 80s She-Ra, not the wonderfully progressive queer She-Ra that's running right now. But in the original She-Ra, she rarely had her own ideas. She was being mansplained things by her horse. And I was like, huh, I never thought of that before. But it was just the nature of that being like that 80s, 90s era where it was very interesting. So like, yeah, like, so to bring it back to Rebels, I like that we're in a time period to where Sabine being a girl is not an issue. It's the fact that she doesn't have the Force, which is the cause of concern, which is just a very smart way of framing things.
Yeah, so I mean, and it's also been determined already by everybody who's been watching the show that Sabine is like a fighter. She's a Mandalorian, you know?
Yeah,
so,
she's
you know,
perfectly capable to fight. So
Right out the bat, the most girly girl Mandalorian is going to kick 95% of people's asses, you know.
Yeah,
you're just gonna stop short of like Jedi, you know. You're sort of short of Jedi, but like on the level of like, you know, Cad Bane type of people, you know.
Yeah. Though I do have a quick little follow up note. I love Kanan's protective father over his teenage daughter energy. I love that like whole like my teenage daughter, I gotta protect her. I love my baby girl. I love that energy. we gotta get moving. My next note is, I love that Rao gives Sabine Mandalorian gear, and I like how they use Finn Rao in this episode, because, like, yes, Sabine has her birth family, and yes, she has her found space family here in the series, and Rao is kind of like this bridge between those two worlds.
Yeah.
Rao is becoming like a Mandalorian uncle for her because he's a tie into her old life, making sure she's getting those Mando things that she doesn't have. But he's
came into her training and said, and she was like he sort of turned around psychologically the training for her, and who knows, Kanan might have it might have been a little plotted too, you know. Kanan might have been a little in on that, even though he was kind of angry about it, but you know, because she's being trained by a Jedi, but at the same time, you're a Mandalorian. She's wielding a weapon that's a bridge between the two things also.
Yeah.
So he comes and gives her Kanan and Ezra can give her the Jedi part she needs, but she needs Fenn Rao to give her the Mandalorian part she needs.
Yeah. And I like this role that he takes because he's very much a tie to her old life, but he's making sure that it doesn't take away from what she has with the space family. So
yeah, no,
I,
that it adds to it, that it complements it, actually.
Yeah, and I really like their use of Rao here. It's a really good use, and he's kind of like becoming this like weird Mando uncle for her. And
yeah.
Like when she puts on the vamp braces and is looking at him, there's a moment on his face where he looks really proud that she's wearing those.
Like Rao has changed fundamentally since the last time we saw him.
Yeah,
you know?
Very much so. For one, they don't keep him in a jail cell anymore.
right, yeah. No, he's an ally now, yeah.
Does so much good for a person when you're not in a jail cell. My next note is, I love the pacing of this episode and how it plays so easily with all the emotional beats. Every triumph and failure has moments to breathe, but we also get to see how each and every character has their own reaction. If this was like some sort of like rebel mission, we wouldn't have those moments. And like, I was thinking about the moment where Sabine uses the Mando tech while fighting Ezra. Sabine and Rao both look really proud in that moment, but then they're very disappointed when Kanan, a Jedi, calls her out on it. And then we see like Ezra's reaction, and then we see like Sabine's reaction, and we get every single person's reaction. And it's scripted so well that every single character gets to have their moments of reacting to things. And I wish we just got more character episodes like this that are slower and character driven, because it's just some of the best.
There's absolutely zero plot devised in this to drive it forward. There is. I mean, there's a reason that she should wield the Darksaber and stuff.
It's not
a plot like, damn, we got to get the Mandalorians here within 5 hours before this happens, you know, and do that. It's not, or we have to, you know, it's not like there's any sort of contrived plot to drive it forward. There's no timer ticking at all. It's just sort of, this is something you've got to do. And it completely has to be done by storytelling, you know, writing.
That's a really good point, because like, they're just camping out for like days on end.
Yeah, usually there's like a mission to provide a framework for it, and something pushing you to the end of the episode, to the end of the story, you know, to keep it moving. And then you have the character beats and stuff going along with it, but you always have a mission that has to be finished, or, you know, somebody that has to be defeated, or something that has to be escaped from, and everything. There is all that stuff in this, but it's all internal. So it's very, very, very uncommon. Not as much these days, but even so, in a show like, you know, a show that's basically a sci-fi adventure show, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, now my Kanan note that I keep saying that I have in here. I know this is Sabine's big episode, but this is also a really good Kanan episode too, because we know in the first two seasons his biggest issue was letting go of Ezra so Ezra could actually grow as a person. And now he's having to do it again with Sabine, because we're seeing him trying to hold on to her. And this is a huge important step in all of their growth, because us watching this again, we know Kanan's going to die in season 4. Like, we know that's coming. So watching this again, we're seeing Kanan allowing Ezra and Sabine to grow up and providing them the tools that they'll both need after he's dead, which is very important for the overarching plot of the series. That's very important for going forward after his death in season 4, that they both have these tools to go on with their own stories. But it also allows him to continue to grow as a Jedi. Like, yes, we know Kanan is a Jedi that's come to learn with attachments and stuff like that, but part of a lot of the Jedi training is learning how to let things go. And so it's also another step in his own journey as a Jedi as well.
I agree. I have something to add to it, but it can go together with your next note. So I'd rather wait till after your next note, because then I could make a more complete point.
All right. My next note has two parts. I'm going to do the first part first. I really love Hera's role in this episode too, because we know from previous stories that she has this rocky relationship with her father, that she's just able to patch. She's just now starting to patch up. So Hera is able to see what Sabine is going through with her own family without knowing any details of what's going on with Sabine and her family. And it's really a great use of Hera using her own, like her own past, to really try and help Kanan help Sabine through this. Do you want me to go ahead and do my next one so you can do your added on one?
Yeah, I can add it on after this one. It sort of dovetails with the last three, sort of.
Okay. This is also a really great important lesson that Hera says to Kanan when she flat out says that this isn't about Kanan, it's about Sabine. And that's a really good lesson, not only for parents, but also for just people in general, because sometimes it's hard to see your own past your own issues to help someone else. And sometimes you have to put your own shit aside to be able to give importance to someone else. And you may still have your own problems and your own issues, but sometimes it's just not about you. And you have to be able to put those aside to help someone else succeed, which is just such a really important thing that Hera like pushes onto Kanan in this episode.
I agree. What I like about Kanan and Hera as the space parents in this is something like the way they do the especially Rebels, is, you know, it's not one of those shows where you have a family like an old sitcom, and, you know, it's sort of everybody sort of grows up by force of the actors growing up and stuff like that, you know, so you have to have them like get jobs and stuff like that as the kids grow up and stuff. But like, I like what they did with this, and they sort of, we didn't have to see this, the progression of Kanan and Hera's relationship. You know, yeah. We didn't, by the time we meet them, they are like very good at staying on the same page, you know, to the point of where you figure, well, it just comes natural for them to stay on the same page. When they discuss something, they're not like, they might get a little heated on it, but they are always working together. And I'm glad that, you know, there's enough other stories in here. It's better to have them as, at least in the context of the relationship, being like a rock, you know, and they regularly give you little glimpses of, you know, how solid their relationship is. It's always in the form of them talking about what's going on when they get to have a private conversation. And it works out really well for the show. Most shows would have messed around with them like arguing and,
or taking, you know, sides.
Taking sides, and then why are you taking that, you know, and having those sort of like tropey relationship problems and stuff, or getting a little jealous of other characters and stuff like that. But no, they don't, you know, that like that's all trivial stuff to them. They've got it down.
We've talked about that before. It was in the season 2 opener, I believe it was, when Kanan, or it might have been it's the season 2 opener because Ahsoka was there, but it was in the episode where Kanan was like, I didn't sign up for a war, and they had that little argument. But we had talked about that. At no point in that argument were they ever disrespectful for each other. Like, Kanan, like, Hera pulls, like, a little rank on him. Just, like, you can't do that in front of, like, you know, a general and stuff like that. But after she's just, like, this is what you did wrong in this work setting, she goes all space wife, and she's, like, let me hear you out. Like, why are you feeling this way? And they've always done that. So, like, I have always loved that about Kanan and Hera, that no matter, even when they disagree, they always hear each other out, and they're always respectful of each other, and they don't try to undercut each other, which is why they're the best fucking parents in all of Star Wars.
Yeah, it kind of sets a high, it's kind of daunting because it sets a high relationship goals bar, but remember, you're talking like a Twi'lek and a Jedi, so most people should know that, you know, you're not going to easily be able to form a relationship like the two of them. But then again, I shouldn't say that, because they probably didn't easily form the relationship. There probably was a lot of trouble at the beginning, especially since Kanan was kind of a drunkard. Kind of a tomcat, kind of a little Yoda in him.
Read A New Dawn. It was not easy. Honestly, the only other, thinking through different Star Wars couples, the only other couple that I can even come close to pairing to Kanan and Hera are Emmanuel and Vanessa Doza from Resistance. They are an amazing husband and wife duo, where they clearly are doing their own thing, but they still love each other. They respect each other. They understand what the other person is doing and supporting each other in those roles. My only gripe about them is Vanessa and Emmanuel never kiss. Let the Dozas kiss. They're married. Let the Dozas kiss. God damn it, Resistance. Let the Dozas kiss. That made me, that's like, I was so mad. I was like, what do you mean they never kiss in Resistance? Ah! It made me so mad. Like, what they do is kiss 2020.
It's the kiddiest one that, you know, so they're avoiding the gross kissing.
I don't care. Let the doses
kids kiss. Don't even want to see mom and dad kiss. They want to see mom and dad kiss less than they want to, than anybody else.
But I mean, they're honestly the only other, maybe the Wrens. I think Ursa and Sabine's father, whose name is completely slipping my mind, they're a pretty good pairing. And I think Aunt Beru and Uncle Owen, what little bit we know of them.
Well, that's what I'm saying. All these characters have not gotten a lot of screen focus except for Kanan and Sabine.
Yeah, because even then, like, Emmanuel and Vanessa are only together, maybe.
Kanan and Hera.
Yeah, Vanessa and Emmanuel are only together, like, two or three episodes now that I think about
right.
it.
That's what I'm saying. They were just sort of a minor side plot in the story, you know.
Yeah.
Probably another reason to say that it was probably meant to go further, because there were a lot of characters that could have been developed. You know, it was set up for it. But that's another story.
That's a podcast for the future.
Yeah.
Well, that's all I have for Act 2. Did you have anything else?
I'm ready to wrap this up.
All right. Act 3?
I'm ready.
Alright, Act 3. That night, the guys are waiting around for Sabine. Rao and Ezra have a little fireside chat, but no one got time for that because Sabine is back, yay! And the music in this entire section is so fracking good. As Sabine and Kanan apologize to each other and then start sparring, and Kevin Kiner and Lucasfilm please release the season 3 and 4 Rebels music. Please and thank you. Thanks. Actually, our buds over at Friends of the Force, Brad Whipple, just recently interviewed Kevin Kiner, which we were talking about last week's episode, or whenever our Rebels Remembered episode is. And Kevin Kiner actually talked about that, about the release of season 3 and season 4 Rebels music. But I won't tell you what he said, so you should go listen to Friends of the Force. Anyway.
I thought it was already out. I thought it had been released.
No, season 3 and season 4 Rebels music has never been released. People have kind of, like, been able to take out the dialogue of episodes and, like, repost it. But, like, there's never been an official release of those two seasons.
Well, I'll just say this about that, though. I can tell the difference. And I've heard some season 3 and season 4 out there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean,
in the wild.
People have recreated it.
Doesn't sound
it,
like it's bled off the Dolby speak, the Dolby surround sound channels. Oh, yeah.
Anyway,
but anyway.
Kanan offers Sabine the Darksaber, which Sabine thinks she needs a little bit more practice with the sticks first. But at Kanan's urging, Sabine finally ignites the Darksaber for the first time. And she says, "It's heavier than I thought," which is a line that has so many multiple meanings and symbolism to it.
Yep.
And Kanan lights up his own lightsaber and slowly starts teaching her part by part, walking her through the history, how lightsabers work and fight, and stuff like that. And then they move on to the lightsaber forms that Ezra taught her. They run through it a few times, going a little bit faster, until Kanan knocks her down. He tells her to get up and start again. And the blade starts feeling lighter to Sabine because she's starting to form a connection with it. And they move on to basic sparring, and Kanan tells her to use all of her skills together. He disarms her, but she looks back at Rao, pulls a Mando, hold my beer, and uses her light whip to pull the darksaber back into her hand and keep fighting. But Sabine is still struggling, and Kanan says that she's fighting herself. And he starts egging her on, saying that she should quit now, which puts Sabine in a teenage rage. And Kanan points out that her people thinks that she ran away from home, which makes Sabine rage even more. And she finally states that she left to save everyone. Her mother, her father, her brother. I watched that, like, one part, like, 4 times, just when she's just like, my brother. And I'm like, yes. And she left to save Mandalore. Sabine finally tells the truth. Sabine built terrible weapons that the Empire turned and used on other Mandalorians. They were used on her friends and her family as a way to control Mandalore through fear. She helped enslave her people. She spoke out and tried to stop it. But when she did, her family didn't stand with her. Sabine starts crying, and Kanan, being the best Jedi dad, comforts her and tells her that she has to keep, she has to help to free her family and her people. And she says that he believes that she's strong enough to do it, because Kanan is the best space dad. Sabine is unsure, but Uncle Rao, oh my god, he's gonna be Uncle Rao now, steps in and says that he would follow Sabine as a leader, and he kneels before her. Ezra and Kanan join in a very Fellowship of the Ring style moment, pulling a, you have my bow, and my axe, and my lightsaber, says Ezra, and they kneel before her too. And Kanan once again gives her a choice. It's up to her what she does next, but her space family will always support her no matter what she chooses. The end. What'd you think of Act 3?
It was good. There's, nobody winning, you know, nobody losing, nobody victorious. They just work. It's just working through it, you know.
Nobody wins through trauma.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not usually though. At the end, it's like, oh, we just blew up the Star Destroyer, and then there's like, you see the bad guys go, they blew up the Star Destroyer. Then you see the good guys go, well, we blew up the Star Destroyer, but how long till they find us? Dun dun dun. The end. This is just. Yeah, a psychological resolution. It had, this one had a great feel of like an old kung fu movie during the when the master finally, you know, agrees to train the neophyte, and it just had a there was a lot of drama in the fighting, you know, that was tied up, and it was very tied into all the emotional things going on. It was just very, very well done. It's one of the, except for the training and fighting, it's one of the least visual episodes of any Star Wars cartoon ever.
I kind of disagree, because I love so much of the lighting in this episode. There's much, like, the lighting sets the mood so much. Like, there's a lot of sunsets and sunrises. There's a lot of darkness in certain points. Like, it's dark. It's nighttime when Sabine finally opens up about her past.
I'm not saying it's not visually good. I'm just saying usually Star Wars tells the story very visually and with action going on and spaceships flying over a beautiful vista of a planet and stuff like that. Especially since your whole show is based on Star Wars and animation, and you're doing it in animation, you know, from the very beginning, because that way it's a visual. Well, it's all a visual medium, but I mean, animation is especially visual, and it's a lot cheaper than filming it as a movie. So, like, it's the format is made to have spaceships and ray guns and, you know, robots fighting and stuff happening, you know, like that, and not to be as much something. I mean, this is there's special effects in it and stuff, but it is completely told. It is completely an emotional journey told with dialogue, voice acting, and writing. You know, that's what carries this show through, especially the voice acting. But the writing is everything is very strong in this episode, and it makes it very compelling. And, you know, you're never going like, you know, I would sort of be expecting at any minute Ezra to be running out going like, everybody drop all your shit, we got to go back in. Or Zeb, you know, comes out on a speeder and goes, we got to go back, we're under attack, or something like that. You know, never happens. And you never miss it. That's all I got.
This is actually where the majority of my small notes are.
I was going to say, these are all little terse notes here.
Except for my one big one. I said this all throughout the Clone Wars, but I don't think I've yet said it in Rebels. I love the sound and the look of the darksaber.
Yeah.
I love that kind of like phew sound it makes, and when it touches, like, there was a moment where Kanan says like the sabers are drawn to each other, and like his saber is touching Sabine's darksaber, and when Kanan pulls back on his lightsaber, you see his lightsaber pull
like
Sabine's.
A magnet a little bit, like
it's
magnetized,
you see her go forward. And so, like, because she goes forward in that moment, it's just really, I love the look and the sound of the Darksaber. I said it all throughout Clone Wars, but I've yet to say in Rebels, I love it.
I love how sometimes it's just completely black, like it's a void of light. But yeah. But when it has little white highlights on it, it's really cool, too, and the little sparky sort of effects to it. Yeah, it's very nice.
It
sounds more mechanical. It almost has a little bit of, like, hedge trimmer to it, you know?
Oh, my God, it does,
almost like it has little, like, blades on it, you know?
Yeah, you're right, it does.
just a little hedge trimmer.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I never thought of it that way.
That's why they have such beautiful artistic hedges in Mandalore.
Mm-hmm.
They're all cut with a darksaber.
You know, something I did watch after, as I was doing this, I was taking a break, that I kind of, it doesn't quite tie into this. It ties in more into, like, the later Sabine episodes, but it has, like, a little bit of a nod to The Mandalorian, too. There's a Forces of Destiny, which was the little 2 to 3 minute, like, animated shorts that they did for all those. And there's one with Sabine and her brother Tristan. And she has the Darksaber in that episode, too. And it's 3 minutes long. But they go and they liberate a statue of Tar Vizsla, of course, who is the original Jedi Mando, because the Empire has built an outpost on top of this statue. And it's a fun little 3 minute watch. I suggest it. I mean, it doesn't, like, add anything great, but it's also just nice to have time to watch Sabine and her brother. But she also uses the Darksaber in that episode. So I definitely, it's on Disney Plus, so go check it out. I like how Kanan has progressed in this episode to let Sabine use her own skills, because back in Act 2, he got mad and he was scolding her for using Mandalorian tech in her fight with Ezra. But now he's encouraging her to use it because he realizes it's part of who she is and it's also part of how she fights. And I was just like, that's
save her life someday, too. So she might as well get used to using that in concert with her Darksaber.
Yeah, so I like that little bit of growth in Kanan just in less than 22 minutes, because just like 10 minutes ago, he was like, how dare you use this on Ezra?
Yeah, and that's the thing is, these guys get along, and none of it seems forced, you know? It doesn't seem like, oh, Kanan just came around. It feels very natural.
Yeah, it's just him just finally accepting that that's just part of who Sabine is.
Everybody very naturally gets to where they are at the end.
Yeah. I just have to give a shout out to Tia Sikar in this episode. Like, I got really emotional watching Sabine break down. Like, I was getting teary-eyed, and Tia Sikar, who is Sabine's voice actress, like, she just fucking brought it this episode. And it's just, you can
everybody
tell.
Everybody did.
Yeah. Oh, and then as we were saying, Freddie Prinze Jr. does too. Like, how often do we hear Kanan yell?
Ezra's voice actor was doing had to go all over the place too. He had to go from being sort of taking it lightly to when they got to training, you could tell there was part of him that was like, you know, I have to show her. But at the same time, there was part of him that really liked being able to show her. But you could tell he was like, Ezra, okay, Ezra, you got to take this seriously. It was really well done.
Ezra had a really, we haven't really talked about Ezra in this episode. But so just to quickly note it, like, I like Ezra's role in this episode too, because he was pretty much the comic relief in this episode. But he was also being a very good brother figure to Sabine. Like, there's one moment where Kanan is talking with Hera and he looks over to Ezra and Sabine, and like Ezra tries to like reposition Sabine's feet with his stick and she just punches him in the arm. He's just like, ow. But you can tell that like, this is just as important to Ezra as well. And he's just as concerned for Sabine too. So he has a really nice balance in this episode as well, as both being comic relief and a support system. So like everyone is just so well, good. The only thing I was like a little bit bummed at was, and this is like the tiniest of gripes, but that's just because he's one of my favorite characters, is Zeb is very early in this episode. He doesn't say anything. And I was like, I just want to see Uncle Zeb be concerned about Sabine too. That's my only gripe. There's not enough Zeb, but there's never enough Zeb for me in any episode because I love Zeb. But yeah, Tia Sikar was, you can tell they built this episode on top of her performance. Like, you can tell. and it's so good. Oh, I know we get to see some of Sabine's weapons later on in the series, but I wonder if we're going to get to see them somehow in The Mandalorian, because Moff Gideon mentions the Empire killing off the Mandos in the season one finale. So I'm wondering if we're going to get to see, like, either in a flashback or, like, see a nod to, like, Sabine's weapons in the series, which I think would be a really cool thing to see.
It's very possible.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about...
People are going to be watching this in Clone Wars, and especially the Mando. You know, there's already online guides of all the Mandalorian episodes to watch in Clone Wars and Rebels. So, that you know, now people will be more... After that first season of The Mandalorian and having time in between for them to geek for the rest of for the season two, people will be picking up the lore, or they'll at least be going to Wikipedia and catching themselves up. A good chunk of them will anyway. I don't see why you wouldn't, you know. Comes with the territory of that of Mandalorian stuff.
I will say our friend of the podcast, Jonna Marie, made a list of Mandalorian episodes and wrote them out on a note card and put the photos online. And I have those photos saved on my computer. So if you haven't, if you're listening to this podcast, you have watched these episodes.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
If you have a friend who's looking for a list of those episodes, hit me up and I can like send those photos over to you for you to pass on to them, because I have those saved on my computer. This is a two-part note. Both have a lot of reading.
This is a big one, folks.
Yeah. So here we go. At the time of this recording, I haven't had a chance to re-upload, because you guys know I'm rebuilding Key Girl Experience right now. Last year, I wrote a post called Rebels Remembered for the first Rebels Remembered. And I haven't had a chance to put it back on Geeky Girl Experience yet, so hopefully it's up by the time you hear this episode. But I did want to read what I wrote about Sabine, especially in regard to this episode. So this is from the article I wrote. I think where Sabine really shines the most is when we see her cracks. Starting off so strong, it was hard watching her break down in Trial of the Darksaber as she faces her mistakes. Seeing her come to terms with her family and fighting to reunite them is beautiful. She's such a complete character when she's both strong and when she's breaking down into tears. Crying does not make her weaker and makes her a better woman as she faces her mistakes. Sabine is such an inspiration to young girls everywhere and another icon that we should love for many years to come. And then I went on to wrote, Trials of the Darksaber is easily the best Sabine episode of the series. As I mentioned above, it's difficult to watch this normally strong and confident woman break down as she faces her mistakes. The entire episode is beautiful, watching her pick herself back up again. She's ready to face her past to be a stronger woman in the future. So inspirational. So my note to tie into that, because that's what I wrote last year. The thing I really like about Sabine in this episode is she starts off so strong from episode one. She's just strong from the get-go. And unlike Kanan and Ezra, who had to grow and go up from the first beginning, Sabine was such a pillar of strength that she needed to be torn down. She shares a similar story to Zeb and Hera in these aspects, but they continue to move up and to grow up and move on past that. But Sabine's story is different. Her story is about moving on, doesn't mean that you get over your pain that is caused to you. We see in future episodes that even when she reconciles with her family, there's still that pain and struggle to connect again. So what makes Sabine's story so good is that she's a strong character from the get-go, but they have to rip her apart to make her come back even stronger. And that's what I love about her, because unlike everybody else who started low and went up, she started high, gets ripped down and has to go back up again. And nobody else in the series has that trajectory of character development, because they start low and they go up. She starts up, goes down, and goes back up again. And she's the only one that has that path in the entire series.
It's a little like basic training. That's what basic training does. It tears down your ego and your structure and replaces it with... She's not as much with the ego in this, because it's not the same thing as being joined into an army. And she's also getting sort of split two ways between you know, not Jedi, but like space family and Mandalorians. So, yeah. But at the same time, it's sort of needed in that, yeah, it's part of the rite of passage, you know, it's, she was strong, but that it was in a tempered strong or and, tempered enough to do what she had to do.
And I just, something I like so much about this is that's something I don't think enough shows do is they let Sabine cry. So often when women are shown crying, they're perceived as weak, which is not the route they go there. They let her have her emotions and they let her mourn and be hurt and be in pain. And they show that it's okay. Cause like Kanan takes her shoulder and it's like, is very understanding, comforts her. And also says that he still believes in her. And that says that she's strong. She's still strong, even though she's in sobbing at him. She says that she's still strong, but we don't. But so often women are written, if they cry, that they're weak, which is an easy and terrible trope that is written a lot. And they don't do that here. And I like that they don't do that here. And they let her cry and still show her as a strong person at the same time.
Well, yeah, it would be hard. It would be hard to make that play well in Sabine's context because she's, you know, she's basically a warrior, you know, like. And her story is kind of like the Shakespearean, you know, Greek myths, you know, story of, you know, it's not just my brother's a dick and my dad drinks too much type of family story. It's, you know, my mother's running the Death Watch, you know, it's fate of the planet and the Mandalorian type story that she's embroiled in, you know, she's in the big A story with that stuff. So like that gives you something to cry about, but at the same time, it would be hard to portray her as being like hysterical over it, you know, because yeah.
And you see that it's painful because again, the pacing of this episode, we see Rao's reaction because when she says that they use this weapons against their people, they have a shot where they go over to Rao and he closes his eyes and lowers his head and he looks in pain because he knows this too. And so like we get to see Rao's reaction to that and he understands that pain as well. And Sabine's own creations killed people that she loved. So, I mean, I love that. You know, I like that you compared her to a Greek myth because a lot of Greek tragedies, like take something like the Odyssey. Odysseus came from a royal high family, just like Sabine. She came from House Vizsla Clan Rin, which is a high ranking family and clan. And like Odysseus, she goes on this journey, gets ripped apart, and comes back as a different person. It's the hero's journey. Right.
She's on the hero's journey. The Mandalorians are on the cursed journey. You know, the Mandalorians just don't have a happy. They don't really have an ending, but they don't have a. They're never gonna have a good time of it. You know, in the past, present, and future, and she's embroiled in it. You know, and now she has to take the call to adventure and step into it.
Yeah, I mean, she's already kind of done that, but I would say this is her diving into the underworld part of the hero's journey, like having to go through that.
Oh, this episode was, yeah. No, she's poised on the hero's journey now, yeah.
Or maybe this is Belly of the Well. I don't know. Anyway, but that's all I have for this episode. Did you have anything else?
No, I'm ready to score it up.
Score it up, Chris. I'm anxious to see what you score it.
I gave it a 9 out of 10. Very hard for a show like this to do a show completely centered around drama, and especially where you have, you know, cartoon face CG characters having to emote their way through a storyline. There's a million zillion ways it could go wrong, and it avoided all of them, and we're complaining in not the last episode because we did that episode about Rebels Day, but in the last show about an episode, I forgot where I was going with that. No, we were talking about the we were sort of saying, you know, Rebels, we could have used some of the political episodes in it, and maybe in Rebels, instead of political episodes, they run the emotional episodes. But as far as this goes, this is a stage play family drama that happens in this. It's not a stage set piece of a battle, and it doesn't slow down for a second, you know. It doesn't not keep you fully engaged from beginning to end, and it takes you on a very natural and smooth emotional journey. Smooth emotional journey. Oh yeah. So yeah, 9 out of 10. How about that? I haven't had a 9 in a while.
I was about to say, you had me like the beginning when we were talking about like our secret scoring, the way you were talking, I was like, did he score this low? Like the way you were talking about it, I'm like,
no.
Did he?
I'm just saying, like, as the visual guy, maybe you would think I would score it low, but I'm not all about the visuals. I've got some depth to me too, Hope. And listeners. How dare you, listeners, think that I would score it because I don't like mushy drama. I like it too.
I was actually, for me, like, I was very surprised by my scoring when I got to thinking about this episode. When I went to go score it, I started thinking, do I have any problems with this episode? Do I have any gripes about this episode? And the Zeb thing is just kind of like a throwaway thing just because I love Zeb. But, like, I don't have any problems with the story. I don't have any problems with the character work. I don't have any problems with the visuals or the music. Like, I can't think of a criticism of this episode. I can't. Do you have any criticisms of this episode?
No, not really.
No, me neither. So when I actually went to score this episode, I started really thinking hard about what I would score it. So I wrote, this episode is flat out amazing. It's well-paced, strong, character-defining episode. The Force has its own play as well in this episode. It's beautiful to look at. The music is wonderful. Kanan and Sabine both have amazing arcs and growth in this episode. Ezra provides humor, but he also has his own role to play. Finn Rao has his own role in this episode. And we get Sabine's past laid out. It's hands down one of the best episodes of the entire series. So I gave it a 10 out of 10. Because wow. If my only complaint is I wish Zeb said something, that's not a real complaint. I think to me, like, this is very, very close to a perfect episode. I don't have any problems with this episode. And we know that this episode is very important to the future of Star Wars when we see it play out in, say, like, The Mandalorian. Like, I could see things in that show come back to this
and
one
other episodes of Rebels for that.
Yeah, matter. So... I sat there and I thought about a long time. I was like, is this a 10 out of 10? And I was like, I don't have complaints. I don't have any complaints for this episode. So I gave it a 10 out of 10.
Excellent.
Well, as always, we would love to hear your feedback on iTunes, Twitter, or on the Two True Freaks Facebook page, and fairly certain soon our website. This week, our feedback comes from Facebook, because I didn't find any on Twitter. On Facebook, for our holiday commentaries for both The Last Jedi and our super mystery commentary of Spaceballs.
Not a mystery anymore.
Nope. Oh, I do have one for Twitter. Haha, I do.
Yes, you do. Okay, so we'll start with The Last Jedi, and we've got one from Gene, the sex machine Hendrix. Says,
I'm sorry, Gene. I'm so sorry.
Gene, the adding machine. Gene, the threshing machine. All right, so Gene Hendrix says, one simple question to answer. Luke wore black in Return of the Jedi because it was the opposite of what he wore in Star Wars. The black version is a little more Jedi-like. George Lucas.
Yeah, because we were talking about, we were like, why is Luke in black? So I'm glad that you noted that, Gene, because I honestly did not know the reason for this.
So I'm all glad right. you corrected us there.
Now we're going to move on to the space balls. See what people had to say about the balls. From Twitter comes one from Spectre 8.
Spaceballs, the comments.
Spaceballs, the Twitter comments.
Branding and marketing are everything.
Spectre 8 said, saw this in my before bed scroll through and had to shake it. Ooh, I'm not hip with your, with this.
She saw it pop up in her feed and she was like, let me give this a try.
So I had to listen to it. Okay. I'm not hip with the new teen lingo, so just bear with me. O, M, letter O, letter M, letter G, whatever that means. I knew it as soon as the intro music played. Can't wait to listen. Oh. Okay. I don't understand your youth talk, guys.
But I try.
I'm trying. Thank you for the comment. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I can't remember what the intro music was.
Oh, it was the dee-dee.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's right. That's right. It had to be.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So now still in the space balls. We're going to see what Paul C. Kelly thinks of the balls. After a hectic day of Christmas gatherings, this was a pleasant surprise to wrap up the night cleaning up presents with the earbuds. You clean your presents with earbuds? Ew. How do you do that? Do you wrap towels around them or something? Okay, well, whatever, man. Whatever floats your boat.
Where's your Paul C. Kelly voice?
I'm not reading Paul C. Kelly yet. That's how you distinguish me commenting on Paul C.
Kelly. Yes, you are.
No, I'm not. I'm speaking as myself right now, Hope.
Okay.
When I read the quote of Paul Kelly, I become Paul C. Kelly. But if I have to comment on it, I have to talk in my own voice, or you don't know who's what's going on. I don't know what's what. And then I start having some sort of identity crisis.
Ooh, yeah. Identity All right. crisis.
So anyway, so we left Paul C. Kelly. He had... His presents were dirty for some reason, and he was using earbuds to clean them. Okay. I knew it right when I heard the Dink song. Oh, everybody likes the Dink song. I knew it right when I heard the Dink song in the intro. I was a big fan of the ludicrous speed and surrounded by assholes gag. Oh, yeah. Funny this movie and Beetlejuice got away with PG ratings having an F-bomb. Beetlejuice yells, nice effing model, which is nice fucking model, after the Maitlands ditch him. Maybe Tim Burton had those connections you speak of as well. I did not know the fact that Pizza the Hut being made out of real pizza.
Gross.
That was a good learned fact.
Gross.
I did hear on a Mel Brooks commentary of this movie that the part where Dark Helmet plays with the dolls, Mel Brooks just let Rick Moranis say whatever he wanted and they used it. Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
There was no script for that. The movie is what made that scene where Poe is trolling Hux in The Last Jedi caused me to cringe. I didn't mind it that much.
Me neither.
I felt like I was watching Spaceballs, LOL. Another example is when Kylo is having a temper tantrum in Force Awakens, and the stormtroopers just back away and go the other way.
I love that moment.
Anyways, great movie. It's probably my favorite comedy of all time. I have not seen a lot of older Mel Brooks movies to compare it to, though, so I might have to watch those. Oh, yes, you do. Actually, after we watched Spaceballs, I watched Blazing Saddles, and all those old Mel Brooks movies are so funny. You need to watch them. They're just a joy to watch.
I need to see them, too.
I did see Young Frankenstein, and that was classic, but I related more to the Spaceballs than that movie, LOL. Young Frankenstein is wonderful. They get better upon, just like Spaceballs, upon repeated viewing. Mike Zumo says, The buildings in the city look like Trade Federation starships. Yes, they do. Aaron Henley says, so after 30 seconds of research, I originally thought PG-13 came out after Spaceballs. It began back in 1984. How did this come out as PG with an F-bomb? Mel Brooks, that's why. That's what exact. Well, Mel Brooks, like, I mean, he leaned into the R-rated movies when he did them. Blazing Saddles is pretty R-rated. But he definitely wanted Spaceballs to be a kids movie. But like, yeah, I'm very surprised they got that F-bomb in there. But Mel Brooks also has probably a little bit of play in Hollywood too. So they might have gone a little easier on him in the ratings because he's Mel Brooks.
You know, I actually
he's got to be a story behind it.
There is. And I remember watching a video of this. A long time ago, and I can't find the video offhand, but it was actually because at the time, the PG-13 rating wasn't created until 1984, which meant anything pre-1984, there was no PG-13 movie. So it was either family friendly or adults only, because those were the only two ratings at the time.
Right.
And so a lot of movies like Jaws and Gremlins, Poltergeist is a PG movie. Ghostbusters is a PG movie. I'm looking at a list right now. Arthur and Airplane, Watership Down of all things, Bad News Bears, Gremlins. These are all PG movies because at
Bad
the time,
Bad News Bears was PG.
Yeah.
Wow. So, I never would have expected that.
I watched a video a long time ago, like of a list of PG movies that people.
Wow.
That were like pre the PG-13 rating of things that like slipped by. So like that's the big thing. If it was either PG or R because there was no PG-13 at the time.
I have to watch the Bad News Bears again to see maybe it just seemed worse when I was a kid. Their swearing seemed worse because they were coming out of kids. But boy, I remember that movie to be just like swearing top to bottom.
Yeah, I wish I could find that video because if I happen to find it by the time I remember.
Oh, well, yeah, first there's and more. Foremost, I remember the movie Barbarella was rated PG, and it had a good amount of nudity in it, if you're paying attention.
Rising PG.
Oh, everybody was on HBO in those days.
Yeah, but I wish I could find it, but there was a really great video on YouTube. Maybe this is it. You won't believe movies are rated PG. Top 10 movies you won't believe are rated PG. I think that's
it. We'll try to remember to post that movie on Facebook with when we post this episode. I'll try to remember to stick that video in the comments.
And I'm checking right now. Oh yeah, it's a Watch Mojo video. It's top 10 movies you won't believe are rated PG. That's the video that I watched forever ago. So, well, that's all I have for Trials of the Darksaber. Did you have anything else, Chris?
No, ma'am.
All right. Well, where can people find you?
You can find me at twotruefreaks.com. That's our website where we have all our podcasts and all that stuff. Soon to be revamped. Keep saying it. It's coming. And you can also sign up for our RSS feeds on iTunes or at our website. You can also find us on Facebook, where we have the Two True Freaks podcast, where we also post all our shows. And we have the Two True Freaks Cantina, which is more of a just hang out and chat spot if you want to come talk about nerd stuff. We are also on Twitter, and our Twitter feed is run by the legendary, many named Gene, the podcasting machine.
Do, 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 do.
Gene. And
the Pokemon Go machine.
Yes, he is a Pokemon Go machine.
Oh, is he really? Gene, if you play Pokemon Go, let's be friends.
I have no idea if he is a Pokemon Go.
Hey guys, if you guys machine, play Pokemon Go, let me know and we should be friends on Pokemon Go.
Anything that can be called a machine to me is going to be Gene from now on.
Gene, the water dispensing machine. Glug, 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 Gene.
Rage Against the Magine.
Oh my god.
All right. That's where you can find me. Where can they find you, Hope?
You can find me at JGuysAndJedi. I run our Twitter account. And you can also find me at Hope Molinax. I am rebuilding GeekyGirlExperience.com, which is my website. I have all my Resistance articles back up. I have almost all my Mandalorian articles back up. And then next will be kind of like my everything else articles. And I'm hoping very soon to start writing reviews of Clone Wars. I'm jonesing to write about Season 7 of Clone Wars. I just haven't had the chance to sit down and do it. I'm just waiting to do it. I'm just so excited. Mostly because when I write reviews, I have to sit down and I rewatch the episodes, and I haven't had a chance to rewatch any of the episodes from season 7, except for the Obi-Wan and Anakin scene, which I've watched several times from episode 2. My favorite is an edit that had the oh shit music laid on top of it. And you can also find me on Archive of Our Own under the name Chaos Lydia, where I write fan fiction. I write a lot of Star Wars fan fiction. With all the shit that's been happening in my life, I haven't had a chance to really write fan fiction lately. I'm hoping that once I get a new job and I get settled back in, I'm looking forward to going back to writing fan fiction, because I miss it so much. I miss writing fan fiction so, so much. So, yeah, that's where you can find me.
Excellent.
Well, next week we're going to be continuing the Sabine family drama, because next week's episode is Legacy of Mandalore, and if I remember correctly, this is the episode where they go back to Mandalore. It is the episode where they go back to Mandalore, and we meet Sabine's mom, and we meet her brother. I don't think we meet her dad yet. I think her dad comes in season 4, but we meet like 2/3 of her family next week, so...
There will be more action in the coming Mandalore stories, for sure.
And I'm so excited to watch these Mandalore episodes, just with the context of the Mandalorian out. I'm glad that we got to watch the Mandalorian before we got to all these Mandalore episodes.
I know, it timed out perfectly, didn't it?
We've
been having great luck with timing in the course of this show, so hope it keeps up.
That's true, because the final Mandalorian episode came out the week before we did the first Mandalore episode of Rebels.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's so, been all through the whole show we've been...
Right, that's what happens when you do, like, 9 commentaries.
I guess so, yeah, that's true.
Well, come back next week for us to make up more dumb names about Jean.
Yes.
Jean, sure. Jean, the cat petting machine. Purr, Jean. Bye, guys.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks. If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Where have you been, Lord? Run, my son. Oh, make my bed soon, for I'm weary from hunting.